This is Co-op Radio, 102.7 FM, and coming up right now is going to be the Animal Voices program, and some of our canine buddies are here to kick things off for us today.
Welcome, everyone, to Animal Voices. In our program, Animal Voices, we envision a world where the human race will finally make peace with the animal kingdom. We envision a world where human beings will no longer kill, maim, torture, and exploit fellow beings for food or any other purpose. We recognize that animals have fundamental rights, and that these rights include that they be treated with compassion and mercy, and that they should be accorded many of the rights that human beings expect to be take for granted. We know that one day these fundamental animal rights will be internationally recognized. Like all of us, animals are capable of suffering. They are not ours to use for food, clothing, entertainment, experimentation, or any other reason. And this is the hope, is that every creature deserves to live a life that in that promised Garden of Eden, the chickens, the turkeys, the pigs and cows, all of them have a right to live their lives free from cruelty, free from the harsh conditions that factory farming and animal experimentation imposes on these wonderful members of the animal kingdom. You're listening to Animal Voices coming to you on CFO Radio 102.7 FM in Vancouver, also known as Co-op Radio. We are listener-sponsored, and you can hear us live on the Internet at www.coopradio.org. And yes, John Pranger, our webmaster, posts these on our webpage, which is animalvoices.org. What could be easier than that? Animalvoices.org. Some of our favorite non-profit organizations include Earth Safe Canada, the Vancouver Humane Society, Canadians for the Ethical Treatment of Food Animals, the Animal Defense and Anti-Vivisection Society, the Animal Advocates in North Vancouver, the North Shore Black Bear Network. All of these operate in Vancouver. And there are many more, like Van Leghold Traps and the Fur Defenders. All of these work together in an increasingly difficult way to counter the tremendous onslaught of animals in North America each year. Today's program, shortly we will be in contact with Judy Stone, the president of Animal Advocates, and she has some thoughts about the latest fur fashion and fur trim on Chinese imported clothing, which is freely available in Canada. At the half-hour mark, we will contact Chris Genovalli, who is the executive director of the Raincoast Conservation Society, and we will hear how these conservationists have paid to end wildlife trophy hunting on 20,000 square kilometers of land on the central coast of BC. Yes, what a wonderful bit of news, and under the direction of the Raincoast Conservation Society. And today, we will be having on in the second hour today, Friday the 3rd, Animal Voices will be on for 2 hours, and we will be featuring a program from Deconstructing Dinner, which is a program which is on the Nelson Co-op Radio, Kootenai Co-op, and we'll be featuring, talking about fish farms. All you want to know about fish farms, that'll be at 1 o'clock today, from 1 o'clock to 2 o'clock. My name is Carl Loskin, and in the control room we have Alan Jensen, and in the studio we have John Pranger and Marge Adams. And over to Marge.
Thank you, Carl. Many of us no longer accept the current concept of animals as our property or as commodities or things. Rather than refer to ourselves as owners of companion animals, we now refer to ourselves and others as guardians of our animal friends, and to the animals as he or she rather than it.
And I'm John Pranger, and ladies and gentlemen, if your dog Fido got sick and were dying, do you believe that it would be medically and scientifically possible to find a cure for your sick dog by experimenting on your healthy Uncle Joe? Ridiculous, you say? Of course it is. And yet the biomedical research industry and its powerful allies have managed to convince millions of people, including the most intelligent among us, that it is possible to find cures for human diseases by experimenting on healthy non-human animals. But increasingly, a large number of doctors and scientists agree that human medicine can't be based on veterinary care. And I recommend to you the book 1,000 Doctors by medical historian Hans Rusch. It's available via the internet if you just look it up. 1,000 Doctors and many more against vivisection.
Thank you, John. And yes, shortly we will have Judy Stone from the Animal Advocates of BC online. But as a little introduction, because we did have the sounds of the canines, the dogs, and our introduction today. Thank you, Alan, for the sounds of the dogs sounding very happy there. And what is more wonderful than seeing dogs? They are so expressive with their eyes, and they tell you exactly how they're feeling. Well, it's not so the case that they're leading happy lives in many of the Asian countries, because some of the reports we have is that it shows that in the Philippines, which is one of the few Asian countries where, in fact, there are progressive laws exist to protect animals from cruelty and abuse, and it included, in 1998, they passed a law forbidding the eating of dog meat. Wow. We've now been alerted that this law is now seriously under threat. There is a proposal to legalize the dog meat trade in one of the provinces in the Philippines. While on the first surface, this appears to be an attempt to preserve local culture and tradition, there is serious concern that the real intention of some government officials is to exploit existing loopholes in the animal welfare legislation, and that this legislation will open a path to a wholesale dog meat industry. It would be a terrible setback for dogs right through Asia if it passes. So there's been appeal on many of the animal rights organizations to write in. But on the other front is that right here in North America, there was a report that Judy Stone sent me this morning, and was about that the average non-Asian American would find it difficult to find boshitang that's in a restaurant in California. Boshitang is, in fact, dog meat. But to a Korean living in California, this is simple. You just have to be able to read Korean for these restaurants, and it showed the pictures of these restaurants where it was advertised. They cater for their own immigrant community, and these advertisements are quite blatant. There is little reason for them to be.
Not to be.
A story in and here we are. Yes, thank you, John. And another story from Beijing, and that said, that mentions that the Beijing authorities had issued certificates for dog meat hygiene and slaughtering to butchers and slaughterhouses, thus legalizing the slaughtering of dogs for meat in China. The byproduct of dogs being slaughtered for their flesh is an abundance of dog fur, some of which is finding its way into stores as trim on parkas for sale in Vancouver. And this is where we go over to Judy Stone. Judy Stone is the director of and founder of the Animal Advocates Association. Hello, Judy.
Hi, Carl.
Yeah, so Now, I wonder if you could give us a little update on what's actually happening with this the fur and fur trim and the resulting goods that are coming from China.
Well, I'll tell you what little I know. First of all, you can't even properly test a product for DNA because the processing of the fur, and it's usually dyed, destroys the DNA. And so you can tell easily the difference between man-made fur, because when you part the fur, you'll see that, in fact, it's attached to fabric. And if it comes from an animal, when you part the fur, you can see that it's attached to skin. So you can tell that it's an animal, but you can't tell, and much of this animal fur actually is rabbit, and it's not okay to do this to rabbits either. But it's very hard to tell whether it is dog or cat fur. So most of the evidence is apocryphal. It's not real evidence, but it's highly suspicious. And in fact, Canada is not interested in the ban, to our great shame. We have a letter here from the International Trade and Commerce Minister, and although he talks quite a lot of reasons why Canada doesn't have this, including he quotes the World Trade Organization's general prohibition of quantitative restrictions on the importation and exportation of goods. That doesn't seem like much of an excuse because other members of the World Trade Organization, UE countries, have banned the importation. But he does have one final paragraph that says that, in fact, they are going to, the Ministry of International Trade and Commerce is going to look into it. And that's where it is now. We don't know how they're going to look into it or when. We have to keep on top of that. His final sentence is, that is why I have asked departmental officials to closely examine Canada's options and legal implications with respect to stopping any potential imports of cat and dog fur. And that's from the Minister, Peterson.
Have you been able to ascertain, you know, there's going to be, spring comes by and there's a large stock of parkas in these stores, and this much of it is being used for trim on these parkas. So that's going to be on sale. We'd like to alert our listeners to what to look at. You've already mentioned you could maybe feel the fur, then you know it is. Probably cat or dog, is it? Or what animal?
You know, if it's extremely soft, it's probably rabbit. But you know, the answer, Carl, is don't buy fur. It doesn't matter where the fur is produced.
That's right.
It's really there's a tremendous amount of cruelty. Whether animals are trapped in the wild and left to die with their legs in traps, or more commonly they're farmed or ranched, as it's called, and then they're kept in absolutely cages, stuffed into cages that are usually dirty, and their lives are nasty and short. So it doesn't matter how the fur is produced.
That's right. Now,
there's cruelty attached to it. Don't buy any fur. You don't have to know whether it's dog or cat. Just don't buy fur.
You know, many people were deceived into believing this was fake, and so the fake fur really opened the door for the real fur to come in and animal cruelty to abound.
But like I said, it's very easy to tell what's man-made and what's not. I mean, really, all you have to do is separate the fur. If there's fabric underneath it that it's attached to, then it's man-made.
Now, you had wrote a wonderful letter to Rick Clough on the early edition, and that sparked me when you sent me a copy of that. And many people can get your email updates from Animal Advocates, animaladvocates.com, is it?
Yep.
And you wrote this wonderful letter to Rick Clough, and I just thought you made your point so clear when you said that it is no more immoral to wear dog fur than chinchilla fur because of the aspects of fur farming, which you just mentioned.
Yeah, and this whole issue came up for Animal Advocate Society because we pointed out the irony in the media a whole week of media PR for these gala celebrations for the Year of the Dog, and the terrible irony in that. And so we wrote the media, and the CBC radio picked up on it. And essentially what I said was that all the production of all food, fur, is immoral, but what sets the dog and cat fur issue apart is the despicable cruelty of the way the animals are killed. And there are websites, many websites, that actually show it. There's videos of it, animals being skinned alive, dogs and cats being kept in tiny little cages like battery hens, thrown into heaps, half dead, their skins stripped off them. It is the way that a whole culture kills animals that has caused us all to say we have to work very hard to stop this.
Yes, I've personally seen it. And John has a question here.
Well, just to carry on a little bit from your last comment, is that is there a whole factory farm system of keeping these animals now and slaughtering them in slaughterhouses? I mean, it seems to be like it's being worked up into a vast system.
Well, of course, yeah, because it's a business and there's customers. And as long as the customers keep buying the product, it'll be impossible to end it. But you can drive it underground and you can lessen it.
But will people continue to eat the meat of the dog? And are they eating the cat meat as well?
Yes. Or, mm-hmm.
I see. So this factory farming system is, well, the fur is almost a byproduct, isn't it? But the whole system is actually in full swing, and
I suspect that.
God, I mean, it's just too horrific.
I suspect there's more than just a byproduct. The business has moved to Eastern Europe, where they don't eat dogs and cats, and the animals are being raised and slaughtered purely for fur.
You know, Judy,
so a lot of it is a byproduct of a meat industry. Yes.
You know, Judy, I was in Vietnam, and when my first day in Vietnam, I went to walk in the street and I saw these dog heads on the table. And then later when I was traveling on the road, this is what I saw, and you know, you give me the opportunity to talk about it. I actually saw truckloads of dogs, and well, I knew what that was happening. But
you know, the thing is that it's easy to criticize all of us on the grounds cultural imperialism, that we it's okay for us to eat the animals that we feel that it's okay to eat, but it's not okay to eat other animals. Well, there is a distinction actually between dogs and cows, and dogs are very, very close to human beings in their natures, and they have been deliberately bred over hundreds of thousands of years to be companions to us. So they're very much like us. And that sets dogs apart, even from cats. And so there is, and so I feel that it is justifiable to make a distinction between eating cows and eating dogs.
Well, you know, in Canada, we slaughter horses some 60,000 every year for the meat industry, and it's still a byproduct of Premarin. So I think...
Well, you know what? It's not okay to eat animals. That's the bottom line. It's not okay to eat animals. It certainly isn't okay to factory farm them.
Right.
But then there's degrees of how cruel the meat industry is. And I would put at the very top, at the highest level, is to take companion animals like dogs who trust us and love us from the time they're born and treat them that way and kill them that way.
Well, maybe you can just have a little word here. We'll go on to the Burnaby issue just to give a little idea of what you're doing with the animal advocates in North Vancouver.
Carl, if I could just say that there are bans apparently in six EU countries, France, Switzerland, Greece, Belgium, Italy, and Denmark. Why there isn't in the UK, I don't know. We haven't been able to find that. Also in the US and Australia, and the US led the way, actually, in the year 2000, and there's fines up to $10,000. But apparently, the industry is getting around it with loopholes in how things have to be labeled. And apparently there's also an entire European Union ban is pending. So I just wanted to let your listeners know that there is some movement.
Yes.
It's slow, as things always are.
And our bill C-27 and C-50 and is been in the Senate and the House of Commons for years,
mm-hmm.
as long as I've been on Animal Voices at least, and we're going nowhere. But it's people like you that make a difference, and I really admire you. I admire you for what you're doing.
It's absolutely shameful that if other countries in the EU, the U.S. and Australia can ban it, and Canada is saying, well, we probably can't. Oh, that's... Anyway... About Animal Advocate Society and our ongoing chain dog, yard dog battle. There's some of the dogs. Just a second, Carl. I'm going to shut the door and see if that does it. In Burnaby, bless them, this is very decent of Burnaby, they decided that they actually wanted to adopt some anti-tethering bylaws, and so they wanted to prohibit tethering of dogs in Burnaby, and that's a wonderful place to start. But unfortunately, what happens is when people are not allowed to tether their dogs, they start keeping them in garages. We get reports of this frequently. They also build pens in their yards instead, so they don't have to tether them. They board dogs up under their porches. And they board them up on their porches and decks. And so, if I was a dog, I'd sooner be tethered and be able to see something than kept in a filthy, dirty, dark pen or garage or under a porch. So Animal Advocate Society went to Burnaby Council, and we showed them some very graphic pictures of dogs in Burnaby in pens and on chains. And we warned them that if they adopt just anti-tethering, that things could be made worse for some dogs. And thank goodness the majority of councillors thought that we had made a good point. None of them were even aware of this. Now the Burnaby SPCA was behind the anti-tethering law, but didn't tell Burnaby Council that there could be, that dogs could suffer even more with a bylaw like that. As far as we can tell, they didn't tell Burnaby Council about all the dogs in pens and in garages. They gave Burnaby Council evidence of tethering, but not evidence of these other cruelties to dogs.
So they passed an acceptable law?
They didn't. We asked them to please send it back to staff and reconsider this bylaw because it was incomplete and could cause worse problems for dogs. As much as we're in favor of anti-tethering, but we also need to let municipalities know if all you do is say you can't tether your dog anymore, worse things can happen to dogs. You have to deal with the whole picture. And so anyway, but we were questioned, did we have any proof that this happened? And I said, well, I'm sorry, but the proof's all anecdotal. People don't like to be, nobody wants to the public to know that they're the one complaining about their neighbor's dog. But I can tell you that, yes, in my years of experience, yes, this really happens. And it was met with some skepticism. That was January the 9th. The city staff at Burnaby have never contacted me to ask me. I mean, what council did was they sent the report back to staff and said, could you please come back and look into this question that Animal Advocate Society has raised? Could you please come back with another report, and we want to know what you find out about this. Well, Burnaby staff haven't bothered to contact me, and I do have the proof. As a matter of fact, a couple of days after I appeared at council, I got a phone call about a person who told me about a dog in Burnaby that had been kept on a 4-foot tether for a whole year in the snow, in the rain, and that people had complained to the SPCA. The SPCA came and told the people that they couldn't keep the dog on such a short tether. They have to put the dog on a long tether. Well, the people didn't want to do that, so they put the dog in the garage. Hmm. But they've got her tied up in the garage on a 4-foot tether because they don't want her scratching their car, of course. So
So what's happening now?
And what these people told me was that the SPCA said it was okay for them to keep the dog in the garage. I don't know if that's true or not, but that's what they said. Certainly, the dog did get put in the garage. That was months ago. The SPCA hasn't been back to see what they did with their dog. So, we could get a lot done if the SPCA would just work with Animal Advocates Society. Right. We could work on this together. We could go to Burnaby Council. The SPCA could back up my evidence. They've got way more evidence than I have that this happens. And we could work together to get a bylaw in Burnaby that was really good. And then, you know, what happens? Other municipalities see the bylaw and they say, okay, we can adopt that. You know, it's adopted in Burnaby, seems to be working, not too many legal challenges. Let's adopt it.
Thank you for being so progressive, Judy Stone. And if anybody would like to become involved in relieving cruelty, right here on your doorstep, whether you live in Burnaby, North Vancouver, West Vancouver, or Surrey, you can go to animaladvocates.com and become a part of Judy Stone's progressive movement to alleviate animal suffering. Thank you for being on Animal Voices. You're listening to Co-op Radio on CFRO Radio 102.7 FM in Vancouver. And over to Alan for a little bit of music.
Always welcome new voices and new energy to the station. Information sessions are held on the third Tuesday of every month. No registration is required. Come on down and add your energy to the People's Station, CFRO 102.7 FM.
Yes, so welcome back to Animal Voices, your favorite animal program. So, today, Friday, we will have a two-hour program of Animal Voices, and from 1 o'clock to 2 o'clock today, Friday, the 3rd of February, we will be playing a program from our sister co-op station in Nelson, B.C., Kootenai Co-op, and we will be playing everything you need to know about fish farming and a wonderful interviews which will really put the green light on it for you as to what there is to know. The Rain Coast Conservation Society is a non-profit research and education organization, and they are dedicated to protect the remaining intact valleys of the Great Bear. Chris Genovalli is the executive director of Rain Coast Conservation Society. By the way, their webpage is raincoast.org, raincoast.org. We have Chris on the line. Hello there, Chris.
Hi, how are you?
Well, just fine, and good to have you here on Animal Voices. And we've been dealing today with what's been doing with dogs in Asia, and it's so good to hear some positive news from you and how you've been able to instrument this in that you've been able to buy the rights to big game hunting for some 20,000 square kilometers on the central coast of BC. That is so amazing. Maybe we need to get a few details about what this means.
Sure, and I think we're equally as excited about having finally pulled off this initiative. Essentially, what we've done is we've bought the commercial trophy hunting rights to an enormous region on the central coast. As you said, 20,000 square kilometers. It's about three times the size of Yellowstone National Park. This area comprises some incredibly rich wildlife habitat, including grizzly bear, black bear, the rare white spirit bear, coastal wolves, cougars, and wolverines. We're excited because, you know, for the first time, a guide outfitting territory, and this is one of the largest ones on the coast of British Columbia, will have carnivore conservation as its priority, as opposed to the exploitation of these animals.
Now, you've had to deal with First Nations and respect their rights as well. How did that fit in?
Well, we had very strong support from the five coastal First Nations who are in this region. They have been really strong advocates for this and have gone even further and have actually called on the provincial government to end the resident hunt of carnivores as well, particularly grizzly bears in this region. You know, our initiative deals with the non-resident hunt, the commercial sport hunt, in which for many years guide outfitters have brought clients from other parts of Canada or outside of Canada, mainly Europe and the United States, to come in and for a certain price hunt a grizzly or another species for trophy. And this kind of hunting that's been going on has been, you know, strictly for what they term a sport, and this doesn't have anything to do with people, you know, providing sustenance for themselves or their families, right?
Now, it's wonderful that we're going to eliminate the trophy hunting in this vast area due to your good work. But the First Nations, do they also have to get a permit to hunt bears or grizzlies?
Well, the First Nations, the regulations that govern First Nations traditional use of all resources, including hunting, is much different than that of the regulations that govern both the resident hunt and the non-resident hunt. So, but the thing is that none of these First Nations involved here have a history of hunting grizzlies, for instance, and particularly, I think the notion of hunting for sport, for recreation, is one that is both kind of alien to them and even as one of the First Nations representatives at our press conference when we announced this said it was sacrilegious to his people to engage in the hunting of these animals for someone's amusement and recreation.
Now, does the provincial government have park rangers there to enforce on an area of 20,000 square kilometers? How many rangers would there be?
Well, that's a problem because there's never been a lot of conservation officer presence in this vast region, and that has dwindled even further because of the draconian budget cuts that the current government has carried out to the conservation officer corps, and that role is going to end up falling upon us in a way. We're going to have to be out there a lot of the year monitoring and managing this territory, as well as partnering with our First Nations allies to, make sure that we've got an eye on what's going on, because the government has essentially abdicated its role in conservation enforcement on the coast, as far as we're concerned. We actually did a study a couple of years ago comparing the conservation enforcement capability in coastal British Columbia with a similar jurisdiction and region in southeast Alaska, and the amount of resources we put to the management and monitoring of wildlife on the coast of BC is pathetically small compared to what they allocate for that in Alaska, for instance.
Now, you've have this license to be the good stewards of this gigantic area in perpetuity.
Essentially, yes. We unless we decide to sell the license, as long as we operate within the law and we're not doing anything egregious to jeopardize our tenure over the area, then we can continue to operate this into the future. And it's a whole new kind of path that we've taken here, and a bit of an experiment, but we're hoping that it will serve as a template for other wildlife conservation efforts, not only in BC, but possibly throughout North America.
Oh, hi, Chris. This is Marge Adams. Chris, it intrigues me how you've managed to get the license, because it seems to me it's very antithetical to our present government's wishes in BC. They seem to go right ahead with things like trophy hunting.
Mm-hmm. Well, we had worked really hard for several years to get a moratorium on grizzly hunting, which the previous government enacted in early 2001. There was a provincial election that year, and that government was thrown out, and the new government came in, and one of the first things they did was overturn the grizzly hunt moratorium, and we were feeling quite frustrated and came up with the idea of, how can we start to take matters into our own hands and be proactive and kind of go beyond governments and processes and whatnot, and came up with this idea of, why don't we look at purchasing guide outfitting territories or, key ones on the coast where we work. And so we ended up negotiating this purchase with the individual who owned it, who'd owned it for many, many years, and he was amenable to negotiating, and we came up with a fair market price, and we raised all the money within about a 12 to 14 month period. Just went out and found people who care about bears and wolves, and no government money was put towards this, and it was kind of a whirlwind experience, but we just took the initiative and went out and did it.
It's wonderful. What a lot of human energy has gone into it, I'm sure. But was there just one person who had the license to that huge area?
Yes, it was an individual who owned a guide outfitting company, Bella Coola Guide Outfitting Limited, and what he had done over the years was consolidate some smaller territories that he had purchased, because these territories, these tenures are transferable. You can buy and sell them with the approval of government. So he had bought a couple of smaller ones to amalgamate with his territory and essentially created one of the larger ones on the coast by doing that.
Now, it's always interesting to know that you had a benefactor and that some people may be interested. It was $1.3 million
yes.
You had to put up with. So it doesn't come cheap
for
nonprofits. But and how important it is for people to leave a legacy. If you don't have any, if you have children who maybe may not be quite as worthy for your spare bequests, then there's always the raincoast.org, and you are such wonderful stewards, and you've shown an example in that you've been so involved to preserve the rainforest as well, and that there is a symbiotic relationship between all the animals, the wolves and the wolverines, as you said, and the bears, and preserving those forests. And you've been instrumental in doing that for so many years. And you were outspoken when Joyce Murray overturned the referendum on grizzly bear hunting, allowing it there. I felt outraged when she did that, and I thought it was literally corrupt. But so some good news from you. But give us a word or two about your activities to preserve the rainforests.
Yeah, we and you know that's been a huge part of our work for over 15 years, is to try to protect these last intact rainforest valleys on the central and north coast, the area known as the Great Bear Rainforest. And, you know, obviously protecting habitat is enormously important for these wide-ranging species like grizzly bears and wolves, and is one of our major areas of activity. And, we also feel that in protecting these areas, you can't legitimately call them protected areas if you're still allowing the direct killing of the species through this kind of unrestrained sport hunting. So we see them as going hand in hand, and given the shrinking habitat for large carnivores in North America and the way they're really, in a sense, I feel being persecuted, both in terms of their habitat being degraded and destroyed by industrial activity, and on top of it being chased down and shot for something as banal as a trophy.
As a wall mounting.
Is a driving factor for us. And in addition to that, we're engaged in a lot of scientific research. We're in the sixth year of a cutting-edge DNA study of coastal wolves, partnered with the Conservation Genetics Lab at UCLA, one of the top labs in the world. And this area we just bought the rights, commercial hunting rights to, is really a core area of our research. So, there are a lot of different reasons why we wanted to do this.
Thank you, Chris. You are the executive director of the Rain Coast Conservation Society based in Victoria. It's easy to look you up, and people should... you've given us the opportunity to have a good news story on Animal Voices, and people should look up your webpage at www.raincoast.org. Thank you, Chris.
You're welcome very much. Thank you.
You're listening to Animal Voices, coming to you on CFRO Radio 102.7 FM in Vancouver, and a little bit of music.
believe it or not, some companies still test shampoos and household products on animals. But 600 companies don't. For a free list showing which is which, contact People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals. That's PETA, Norfolk, Virginia, 23510.
Yes, yes, and a study by the University of Arizona found higher levels of coliform bacteria in the American kitchen than on the rim of the toilet.
Yikes.
Yikes. Foodborne Disease Authority Nichols Fox says, the bathroom is cleaner because people are not washing their chickens in the toilet. And with that note, over to Marge. What have you got for us?
Thanks, Carl. Here's an interesting item. It's called, It's Better to Green Your Diet Than Your Car. And it's from the New Scientist. Thinking of helping the planet by buying an eco-friendly car? You could do more by going vegan, says Gideon Eschel and Pamela Martin of the University of Chicago. They compared the amount of fossil fuel needed to cultivate and process various foods, including running agricultural machinery, providing food for livestock, and irrigating crops. They also factored in emissions of methane and nitrous oxide produced by cows, sheep, and manure treatment. The typical U.S. diet, about 28% of which comes from animal sources, generates the equivalent of nearly 1.5 tons more carbon dioxide per person per year than a vegan diet with the same number of calories, says the researchers who presented their results at a meeting of the American Geophysical Union in San Francisco last week. By comparison, the difference in annual emissions between driving a typical saloon car and a hybrid car, which runs off a rechargeable battery and gasoline, is just 1 ton. If you don't want to go vegan, choosing less processed animal products and poultry instead of red meat can help reduce the greenhouse load. So there you have it. It's better to go vegan than have a green car.
What a lovely, simple solution, eh? And it's all made out to be so difficult. Now, here we have some life force news. The Heart and Stroke Lottery, not very lucky for animals. Some of the funds from the Heart and Stroke Foundation Research Lottery, which is being run on the radio, their advertisement, that money will be spent on painful and scientifically fallacious experiments on animals. These Heart and Stroke Foundations in B.C. and Ontario don't have any policy opposing experiments on animals. They continue to use what they call animal models. Researchers create these animal models of heart and stroke injury to test drugs and other methodologies. But they're not actually studying the actual human maladies, and animals react differently to the methodologies tested. There are major biological and anatomical differences between animals and humans. The peer review system and the pro-vivisection organizations, such as the Canadian Council for Animal Care, the CCAC, they're on the web, protect the animal experimenters, not the animals. But they say they do. The CCAC inspections are confidential, and there are no bans on even the cruelest practices. Life Force is the only organization in Canada that has succeeded in laying cruelty to animal charges against researchers. Their 1984 case exposed the practice of restraining baboons for 4 months in experiments funded by the Heart and Stroke Foundation of Ontario. You can contact the Heart and Stroke Foundation at www.heartandstroke.ca. That's www.heartandstroke.ca to express your concerns, and you can go to their contact us link to send an email, and you can send Life Force a copy of their response. And may I just say that men are the devils of the earth, according to Arthur Schopenhauer, the German philosopher, and the animals are the tormented souls.
You know, John, I would like to ask you about an article that was written by a very well-known British Columbia environmentalist, and he says he almost condones as acceptable that it's okay to experiment on chimpanzees because we need to find our evolutionary roots, and also that to discover why humans are so much more susceptible than chimpanzees to problems like heart disease, AIDS, and malaria. What would you say about that, John?
Well, these conditions never occur in the animal kingdom. They're strictly human diseases, so you can't model them in animals. And it's no good knowing why they don't receive, because that would mean why they are different, because that would mean that somehow or other the objective is to alter the human being more like the monkey or the particular animal model that people imagine stands for the human being. And that's not a way for us to go. Now, this attitude of Dr. Suzuki, I think, just is something that's ingrained in him because he has himself a background of research on fruit flies. Now, the fruit fly may be a very lowly animal in the scheme of things, but it is unique in its physiology and biology and cell structure and in every way. So there's no comparative studies that can be done between the animal and the fruit fly, and that goes for every animal and every species. It is simply a wrong way of thinking, and Dr. Suzuki is very much has had this idea inculcated into him from his school days, and he doesn't seem to want to give up on the idea.
Thank you, John, for your comments. And whether it's the fruit fly or the chinchilla or the horse, I don't really see any great difference. I know that once I read about the sex life of the fruit fly, and it was amazing how... I can't remember all the details, but very complicated, and could become part of a pornographic movie, I think. But and then I went to a neighbor of mine, and it was summer, and there were lots of fruit flies over her bowl of bananas and apples, and she took her vacuum cleaner to the top of the fruit bowl, and I was appalled. Now, on a more cheerful note, I didn't say anything. I didn't want to sound absurd. But, we're all at different levels of sensitivity. And my heart was with these sexual beings, the fruit fly. Over to Marge, and she has a story. We only have about 4 minutes left, is it?
Yes, and it's just maybe not quite that long. This is a story about an intelligent and a sensitive dog that... makes quite an effort to save his friend. And the story is called A Friend in Need, and it's by Stephanie Lalonde. Brownie and Spotty were neighbor dogs who met every day to play together. Like pairs of dogs you can find in most any neighborhood, these two loved each other and played together so often that they had worn a path through the grass of the field between their respective homes. One evening, Brownie's family noticed that Brownie hadn't returned home. They went looking for him with no success. Brownie didn't show up the next day, and despite their efforts to find him, by the next week he was still missing. Curiously, Spotty showed up at Brownie's house alone, barking, whining, and generally pestering Brownie's human family. Busy with their own lives, they just ignored the nervous little neighbor dog. Finally, one morning, Spotty refused to take no for an answer. Ted, Brownie's owner, was steadily harassed by the furious, adamant little dog. Spotty followed Ted about, barking incessantly, then darting toward a nearby empty lot and back, as if to say, "Follow me, it's urgent." Eventually, Ted followed the frantic Spotty across the empty lot as Spotty paused to race back and forth encouragingly. The little dog led the man under a fence, past clumps of trees, to a desolate spot a half mile from the house. There, Ted found his beloved Brownie alive, one of his hind legs crushed in a steel leg hole trap. Horrified, Ted now wished he had taken Spotty's earlier appeal seriously. Then Ted noticed something quite remarkable. Spotty had done more than simply lead Brownie's human to his trapped friend. In a circle around the injured dog, Ted found an array of dog food and table scraps, which were later identified as the remains of every meal Spotty had been fed that week. Spotty had been visiting Brownie regularly in a single-minded quest to keep his friend alive by sacrificing his own comfort Spotty had evidently stayed with Brownie to protect him from predators, snuggling with him at night to keep him warm and nuzzling him to keep his spirits up. Isn't that a lovely story?
Thank you much, and you always have a book full of stories there. And John, thank you for mentioning that great a quote from that great philosopher, Arthur Schopenhauer. And I'll just repeat that John, it's given me permission to repeat it. Arthur Schopenhauer, the great philosopher, said, "Men are the devils of the earth, and the animals are the tormented souls." Well, John, I'm going to contribute towards your idea here, because there's another philosopher, who Theodore Adorno, and he said that Auschwitz begins whenever someone looks at a slaughterhouse and thinks they're only animals. Every creature deserves to live a life in that promised Garden of Eden, the chickens, the turkeys, the pigs, and the cows. All of them have a right to live their lives free from cruelty and free from the harsh conditions that factory farming and animal experimentation imposes on these wonderful members of the animal kingdom. Our webpage is www.animalvoices.org, www.animalvoices.org. Many of our programs are listed by going to the audio, and you can hear this program. It will be listed. You can hear it again. Be our guests. And Alan Jensen is the control room. Marge Adams is going on holiday in a few weeks to Cuba. I wish you a wonderful holiday. We'll be here sitting in the rain in the dark.